I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On today's episode, we're going to be talking with Dr. Matthew Johnson. Matt is the Susan Hill Ward Professor in Psychedelics and Consciousness and Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Johns Hopkins. We're going to be talking about the history of psychedelics in the United States and the ongoing research to understand the therapeutic value of psilocybin.
All right, Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Agreed. We're really excited to have you on. I think this is a really interesting topic that our listeners will be excited to hear about. So at the beginning of each show, we like to start off with having our guests talk a little bit about their training history. And this allows us to understand a little bit about their expertise area and understand a little bit about their journey of how they ended up where they are. Could you tell us a little bit about your training history?
Yeah. So my undergraduate degree was in psychology, and I became very interested actually in drugs at that time and did some cocaine research in rats at the time. I went into graduate school, really honed in on the areas of behavioral pharmacology or psychopharmacology. My degree was not only experimental psychology with biobehavioral emphasis, but that can mean a million things. For me, what it meant was really studying drugs and behavior, or with different language, you could say drugs in the mind. You know, psychoactive drugs, whether we're talking, you know, legal, illegal, whether we're talking about caffeine or cocaine, you know, medications or recreational drugs, you know, across the board, psychoactive. So including studying addiction. So not just the effects of drugs, but the patterns of behavior that people get into with drugs with reinforcing effects. And so what we call addiction or substance use disorders, although I do think there's something specific to the scientific notion most closely associated with what we call addiction per se. But that was at the University of Vermont, where I did my graduate work. And that was with Warren Bickel, was my mentor, who's a huge name in the behavioral economics in substance use disorders world. And so early on, this was all with humans. So I transitioned from non-human work as an undergraduate to human work, starting in grad school, but doing work looking at things, both things like delayed discounting, which is how people evaluate the future and how that's turns out very tied to addiction potential, in terms of whether an individual is likely to become addicted to a substance. Also, behavioral economic analyses, such as concepts like demand elasticity, using these analyses typically used by economists to understand monetary behavior, using these analyses to understand drug use, things like cigarette smoking, the patterns of drug use. Of someone in the laboratory, for example. So, and then I did a postdoc after I got my PhD, postdoc at Johns Hopkins in the same research unit that I'm at now, the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit, getting involved with all kinds of drug administration research, cocaine administration, sedative hypnotic administration, alcohol, eventually with methamphetamine, a whole range of drugs, including novel drugs, but also including psychedelics. So I've studied both kind of very in-depth the psychology of addiction, particularly from a behavioral economic lens. But then another side of my research is really delving into drug effects themselves, especially psychedelic drugs. And so at an interesting intersection between those two areas are the therapeutic effects of psychedelics, including their use to treat addiction.
Yeah, that's so
that kind of sums it up. Yeah,
yeah, that's really interesting. I'm a small fish in the ponds, as you might say, in the behavioral economic realm, and so obviously follow Warren Bickle's work a lot, follow your work a lot. Really excited to just get to chat with you about all these things. You've done a monumental amount of work. And today, like, as you mentioned, your work in psychedelics, I think we want to focus in on specifically, because you are doing some fantastic work in that. And so just a brief overview for our listeners, psychedelics or psilocybin specifically is a Schedule I substance, meaning that it, according to, the government, at least, it has a high potential for abuse. It's not currently accepted for any medical use in any treatments, and a lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision overall. So, there's been a lot of interest throughout history in psychedelics generally and psilocybin specifically in the therapeutic effects. And it feels, maybe just because I'm just becoming aware of it, but it feels like there's a renewed interest in recent times. And so that's kind of what we want to talk to you about today, like what the history of this is like, maybe what's going on now and what kind of work you're doing in this area, and then, you know, what you expect mm-hmm. to happen. And I wonder if you could just start by talking to us a little bit about, you know, how did it become Schedule One, and what's the history behind it and its sort of relationship with the United States?
Yeah, so psilocybin, as well as the other major so-called classic psychedelics like LSD and mescaline, dimethyltryptamine, DMT, they were put into Schedule One when the Controlled Substances Act was enacted. And so when that was put into place in 1970, most of the known classic psychedelics were put into Schedule One, and the various other drugs that out there were put into various schedules, cocaine into Schedule Two, methamphetamine in Schedule Two, a lot of the opioids in Schedule Two, because they have accepted medical uses. This did not stop research. I mean, the story of the research kind of goes back to, I mean, gosh, there was some interest around the turn from the 1800s to 1900s, around the time when mescaline was first isolated as the active principle in the peyote cactus by Arthur Hefter. But the field really kickstarted about a half century later when Albert Hofmann synthesized and then discovered the effects of LSD in the late 30s, the early 1940s. He first synthesized it, but he kind of tried it on himself a few years later. And that just started, that was a pharmaceutical company he was working for, Sandoz. And so they were very intrigued by the potential of this drug to either treat mental illnesses or to at least be used as some sort of experimental tool to understand mental illness. It seemed like people were imitating. It was like, for some people and some reactions, it was like a temporary psychosis. And so they basically would send bottles of this stuff around the world to clinic. Anyone wanted to do research, and there were no standards. I mean, you could just be a clinician, essentially, you know, trying it out, you know, on patients. And so they sent around a lot of this LSD. Delicid was the brand name. And they sent in these little vials, and this was LSD was really at the cutting edge of neuroscience and psychology and psychiatry for a few years back then, because really before any of the negative media reaction and public reaction happened, it was seen as sort of this sort of, you know, unprecedented lens on the mind. The ability to, you know, both treat disorders, but to also to understand the nature of mind. And there was growing the psilocybin mushrooms first hit the public awareness in 1957 when Gordon Wasson, a banker who as an amateur mycologist or someone who studies mushrooms, he became obsessed with the idea that the world's religions related to a core, descended from a core mushroom worshiping cult. Hmm. And so he was sort of, and there's some serious academic critique of, he was sort of finding the situations, you know, in terms of his ethnography, of his anthropological pursuits that you know, were, happened to match his preconceived notion. So, yeah. So he is an amateur. Nonetheless, he figured out that native peoples, and this is in Oaxaca of Mexico in the mountains, this Mazatec tribe, they were using psilocybin, these mushrooms that had this, call it whatever you want, hallucinatory, psychedelic, that was before the term psychedelic existed, but this extraordinary effect on people, and people were doing ceremonies with it, and found this healer, Maria Sabina, she was a shaman, essentially, and ran Wasson through some of these ceremonies. He actually sent a sample to Albert Hoffman, the guy who synthesized LSD, yeah, who isolated and figured out what the active compound was. There was this kind of, in Life magazine ran a whole story on this, the rediscovery of this mushroom, because it had been thought going back to the, at the times of the conquest of the New World, like 500 years ago, there were accounts that sounded like there was a ceremonial use of mushrooms, but historians had then come to believe, well, they were really talking about a cactus. It was, you know, something like peyote or something. It wasn't. So it was like the rediscovery to the Western, at least the scientific world, that this really was, there was a mushroom that had this effect, and that kind of led to a popular increase in interest in the mushroom. It was back in the day, though, it was the only people that were doing mushrooms were in the, like, you know, like mid-60s, where people, kind of like the people now that might go to Peru for an ayahuasca ceremony. There were the people that went to the mountains of Mexico seeking the mushrooms. The psychedelic people were using on the street was LSD. There was a whole, it was really seen as at the cutting edge of different facets of science. And then it all kind of abruptly ended in the really the early 1970s. It wasn't because they were placed in Schedule One. That increased the bureaucratic obstacles. But in fact, they're still in Schedule One, and it does take a lot of paperwork, but it's still possible. The so-called modern renaissance in psychedelic research is happening in the context of them still being Schedule One drugs. It was really the professional marginalization. I mean, this went from, like, you know, it was like ended up being a career killer. You know, you talk to some of the folks that were coming up and went to grad school or medical school hoping to do work with these compounds and the early 1970s, and it was like the carpet was pulled out from under them in terms of, you know, you tell this to your department chair or your graduate advisor. And by that point, people were not only familiar with like the history of Timothy Leary at Harvard.
Yeah.
And, but also even at the end of the 60s, Charles Manson had been using LSD to brainwash his cult into this sort of maniacal, like, vision of a race war, and they murdered people. You know, so like, you know, some of the worst possible connotations that, and there were definitely casualties from the reckless use of LSD when it became popular, and doses were very high on the street in those days, more so these days, according to data. But nonetheless, the public was really scared, such that, you know, the sentiment was you couldn't even trust the scientists with this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like Timothy Leary did a good amount of damage to a lot of these movements in sort of the actions that he took, you know, right or wrong. Because it seems like a lot of people did have this perception that, like, oh, you know, this is what's going to happen. You know, if you're using these, and then again, with all of these other examples that get thrown around in the public domain in the media about usage that's associated with something violent or something like that. So it sounds like what you're saying in part is just, it became sort of ostracizing.
Yeah. And And there were people that were begging Leary to, you know, a lot of the kind of the folks the public doesn't remember, like Humphrey Osmond and Abram Hoffer and Sidney Cohen, kind of some real heroes and the psychedelic researchers that didn't, you know, capture the public eye like Leary
right.
did. Begging him to like tone it down, like, man, you're gonna make this whole thing blow up on us. I mean, they really were explicit about this. He was like, no, man, this is bigger than all of us. And but I have to say, I have a colleague who says, you know, if Bill Richards says, if Tim Leary wasn't Tim Leary, someone else would have been Tim Leary. So I think there's some truth to that.
Someone had to be a Tim Leary.
Yeah, I it really was. I think it would have collapsed even if it wasn't for Tim
right.
Leary. I think he did serve, being a professor at Harvard, did serve as kind of like the ultimate example of, see, you can't even trust the Ivy
the Harvard
League,
guy.
You know,
yeah.
You know, Harvard psychologist to, you know, you can't trust them, so you can't trust any. But anyway, Leary was literally expelled from not one but two universities when he was a wild man from the very beginning.
Right.
Very heavy drinker, tied into that. And don't get me wrong, I mean, he was a brilliant man and absolutely fascinating. And he was well known and respected as a personality researcher even before his psychedelic work.
Yeah.
And he was even brilliant in his descriptions of the psychedelics, but certainly he pushed things too far and didn't. And then the research wasn't, you just don't have the sessions at your house on Saturday night. That's number one.
You know? Yeah.
Like that's,
yeah.
That's,
well, the
you
research,
call that research, but
right. Yeah. I mean, there has to be, I don't know. I feel like for the public to catch on to some of these things, sometimes there has to be some level of formality and seriousness taken in order for it to just, you know, seem like it's passed all the tests at the very least. Right. So it sounds like Timothy Leary, he kind of went a little bit off the road sometimes.
Yeah. But I think it was going to crash anyway.
Right.
I mean, there was
right.
just enough. It, I mean, there really were casualties out there with, you know, I mean, this is a difficult area because on the one hand, you don't want to, yes, there were the urban legends of, oh, I mean, government put out pretty quickly based on like one or two like in vitro data papers that like LSD, you know, had chromosomal damaging properties and it was a risk to your babies. And this was right after, a few years after thalidomide, which everyone in society knew about because of the deformed babies with the horrible. I mean, that just like kind of rocked. I mean, that transformed.
Everyone was a little bit more vigilant and sensitive.
Oh yeah, you start talking about like, you know, chromosomal damage in babies, you think thalidomide.
Totally, yeah.
Babies
yeah.
with flippers, and it's just like, you know, the most horrifying thing, you know. And but there was never any evidence that this, by any number of ways of analyses, that this translated to anything. Lots of compounds, you know, apparently caffeine will do the same thing in a petri dish. A lot of things will break up chromosomes when they're
right.
It's introduced as a pure chemical in a petri dish. Anyway, there's things like that, but then there's things like jumping out of windows. Now, so here's the thing: sometimes people do jump out of windows when they're on psychedelics. It's really rare, but sometimes it does happen. I have a file folder full of cases, and sometimes in the medical literature, sometimes written up in the popular press. But you know, in a lot of cases, you don't know whether the person thought they could fly or whether it was just like, you know, just been being intoxicated. I mean, every year, how many people fatally fall from a height on alcohol?
Right.
I mean, highly intoxicating drugs in public situations will lead to, you know, sometimes these accidents. But the, you know, by all the data, the rates of these types of problems are, I mean, they pale in comparison to the harms with other drugs like the ER visits due to cocaine, any, you know, you pick your class of drugs, the opioids, certainly. The public health harms are small, but they're real. That's the thing. It's like, you know, there are cases of someone having a bad trip who did something really dangerous and died. There are very real cases like that. At the same time, it sometimes it was portrayed as the inevitable conclusion of a bad trip is the person who's
right.
going to kill themselves, which is like there was this military video that essentially said just that. It was like, okay, come on.
Yeah, like people that were might having
a lot of bad trips that don't always lead to someone trying to commit suicide. So I'm kind of very similarly in terms of their therapeutic potential at this point, based on the data. I think the data are extremely promising, and I think they're poised to really have a transformative effect, like create a new kind of subspecialty in psychiatry. And it's hugely interdisciplinary, so a huge role for clinical psychology and for, and we'll see the professions, you know, social work, et cetera, nursing, you know, to serve as different roles in these therapies if they're approved. As medicines, but you know, there's sort of this balancing act between, like, you want to say, yeah, the data really do say this is pretty unbelievable. We need to keep following this, and this has potential to really help a lot of people. Versus on the other hand, it's like, this doesn't work for everyone. Nothing works for everyone. A lot of times when it does work, it doesn't look like the most stellar case you may have heard of.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's in between, and there's a benefit. Sometimes there's no benefit, just like, again, anything else. And so you want to, and you also don't want to get into the area, I find, in terms of trashing other treatment modalities, including traditional medications, which in lots of cases are overused, depending on the disorder. Certainly opioids for chronic pain and ADHD meds in kids. I think there's some cases there. One could argue, or, you know, they're being used too many cases. At the same time, I think, hey, this is a big world, and it's hard being a clinician. I think you need more tools in the toolbox than fewer. Right. So rather than kind of replacing traditional medications, and we recognize their limits, like SSRIs have helped some people. Yes, there's a lot of room for improvement, but some people, they're no doubt here, and they didn't commit suicide because, you know, there were those few points on the whatever depression scale, the HAM-D or whatever, is the difference between in a suicidal range or not. And so the balance of, like, not trashing, this is something exciting and new, but also not kind of trashing the traditional treatments, which we still need to.
Yeah.
Having the toolbox, including behavioral treatments and psychological treatments.
Yeah.
Most certainly. I was wondering if we could dive in there a little bit, and maybe you could walk us through a little bit about some of the therapeutic effects that we know about psilocybin, while kind of also balancing that, I guess, a little bit with some of our, thinking about, you know, addiction potential or other kind of adverse related event potential. As you've kind of alluded to there, I wonder if we could walk through some of that stuff.
Yeah. So what the promising therapeutic effects.
Yeah.
The in terms of what's published so far, the kind of the most rigorous stage of research is for the treatment of distress in cancer patients, primarily measured by depressive and anxious symptoms. And so there's not a DSM diagnosis for cancer-related existential distress, whatever you would call it.
Right.
But it really, I think there's a literature to argue. I bet it's going to be something like that. Maybe it's disease related. But I bet a future DSM will have it, because it does seem like a distinct phenomenon that's not the same as major depressive disorder or any other.
Tied to like a specific thing. And yeah.
Yeah. It seems, I think, less. You know, more resistant to traditional antidepressant treatment, and clearly, like, tied to a thing, you know, this,
yeah,
you know, whereas people weren't depressed before. And so there's something about the nature of it. But anyway, there's three double blind studies treating that, all finding large reductions for psilocybin in reducing depression and anxiety scores up to months later. I mean, so we went up to 6 months, and the results, the reductions in depression and anxiety looked like they were a month after the treatment. And then our colleagues at NYU did over 4-year follow-up on average, and found, and it was a subset because a lot of people passed away,
but yeah,
found that same trend. that really hadn't changed. And then with depression, there's been a few studies, an open label study that looked promising. We published in JAMA Psychiatry a randomized waitlist study that found a large effect with the reductions in depression compared to a waitlist, which is arguably sort of the kind of minimal level kind of form of a randomized controlled trial. But then in New England Journal of Medicine, our colleagues at Imperial College published a double dummy comparison, psilocybin versus escitalopram, and found on the primary measure of depression that psilocybin trended better, but it didn't meet statistical threshold. But on a whole host of other depression measures and quality of life, psilocybin looked significantly better. So minimally, it looked as good as an approved antidepressant, but it actually showed up at the trend level that it might be better.
Rare. It's kind of hard to do that. A lot of times when we compare our active treatments with other active treatments, there's no difference.
And this wasn't set up, though, as a non-inferiority trial or something. It was really underpowered for all that, but at least in terms of finding, again, that general, and I forget whether it's something 30 or something in each group, I think. So, fairly small sample size. I think that trend for these things that we would expect, like quality of life, it makes sense that you would see that with psychedelic therapy. Hmm.
Yeah, agreed. I think these are important findings, right? Like, and I'm curious a little bit about, and if we may, I understand all the trials are a little slightly different, so maybe we could speak to yours most specifically, mm-hmm. but what's the kind of dosing that we're talking about here and just kind of logistics of how that, is it like a full dose with a trip sitter, or like, are we doing a counseling session in concert with it? And what are the type of side effect profile that we see? Because SSRIs have a very specific side effect profile, of which many people hate vociferously, like sexual side effects and weight gain and things like that, especially teens that I work with, they're just like, get out of here with this trash. And they take like 100 years to kick in, where psilocybin has a very different. So I was wondering if you could just walk us through a little bit of some of that.
Yeah. I guess I'll go ahead and talk about the risks. I mean, the thing about all of them, the nice thing about the compared to, let's say, you mentioned SSRIs, rather than taking a pill every day, where the treatment model is only taking the pill in the treatment center when you're being monitored, you're not let home until the drug's out of your system, monitored with a physician on hand, just in case, et cetera. When someone's prepared for the experience, the risk profile with someone to screen, it's a very strong benefit risk profile. I mean, it compares very favorably to lots of stuff we do routinely in medicine or clinical psychology. Broadly speaking, the risks are, it seems like psychedelics can destabilize people with psychotic disorders, such as schizophrenia or mania in the context of bipolar disorder. So, very extreme forms of mental illness of the reality distorting types. And it kind of makes sense that if you're kind of holding on to the real world by a thread, psychedelic, experience, because that at least temporarily strongly breaks you from the everyday world. That's kind of what they're known for. And then for anyone, but obviously we can screen those people, and that seems very reliable from thousands of participants. And just what we know generally, if you run people through a SCID or another structured psychiatric interview and spend a few hours, depending on the nature of their history, spend some time with them, it's very reliable to detect someone who is morbidly psychotic or actively suffering from a psychotic disorder. So, but then anyone who's psychologically healthy could have a bad trip, meaning at a high enough dose, they can have anxiety, fear, confusion, something like this, you know, a negative emotion that leads to panic. And that can escalate out of control. And typically it's in the person is more in kind of like flight mode than fight or flight, but people have also been, have engaged in violence. It's again, pretty rare. I don't want to overstate it, but when one really has an extremely distorted, you know, kind of picture of the world. So, and so there, you know, here the person's in a safe, they're prepared for the experience. They're with people they've been paired with for a number of hours, at least 4 hours, maybe up to eight, depending on the study. It's not that clinical rapport reduces the paranoia being around people one trusts. So, you know, sometimes you get into problems with, you know, people at a concert where there's a bunch of strangers and maybe you shouldn't be trusting everyone like in the world. It's good, you know, and so there can be this amplification, the psychedelic experience of that. And so anyway, those factors are controlled for, and so where the person is never left alone, they're monitored during the entire thing. The strongest, most reliable antidote for a challenging experience, and I do say challenging in this context because it's not, the bad thing is if it has a bad outcome, if someone panics and does something stupid. So it can actually be, having some of those more frightening experiences can actually be therapeutic, even though we try our best to minimize those difficult experiences. So we kind of frame them as challenging experiences. If your experience is a dark one that you have to move through, you know, much like, you know, taking a lesson from, like, say, the treatment of trauma from empirically validated therapies, the way through is not, the way is in and through. I mean, sometimes it seems as if difficult psychological material seems to emerge, and there's a sense that, you know, one needs to process it rather than kind of ignore it. And it does seem like it's weird, like, you know, you're treating smoking and sometimes stuff will come up like a trauma from 40 years ago. I'm thinking of one particular case of a lady we treated. So it is, there's, you know, and so it's not controllable, such as like, oh, this is just about smoking. It's not about that, but it's, then when that material comes up, it's about, you know, being able to, you know, kind of psychologically deal with it, process it.
Yeah. So it sounds like there's someone in the room, and it also sounds like a lot of those variables that you mentioned, like, you know, you're at this point, you know, trying to understand the medical, you know, therapeutic use of this. And so in a lot of those cases, it would be in, you know, where the risks that you mentioned are in sort of unsupervised scenarios, mm-hmm. when right. other people aren't around, you know, and people maybe who don't, you know exactly what they're doing, those things become more likely. It sounds like in this case there, you know, you can, you know, it can be relatively safe. So when they're in this room, right. that they're being monitored, is this something that is guided by someone, or is it sort of self-guided? Do they have sort of any instructions of what they're supposed to do while they're there?
It's really self-guided in a sense. We do refer to the monitors or the as guides, but it's probably a misnomer in a sense that. And, you know, you could say generally therapist, but at some studies we have a licensed therapist in there. Some studies aren't treatment studies, even if it's. So anyway, I just want to, you know, sometimes we use the more generic term of a monitor or a guide, mm-hmm. but even if it's, again, guide might be a misnomer because the instructions are to trust, let go, be open. Don't try to control the experience. Just absorb. Experience what it's very much kind of in the spirit of mindfulness. Whatever emerges is what you're supposed to be absorbing, and try to take a non-judgmental. It might be beautiful, might be horrible, but just it is what it is. You're having the experience. You collect experiences. At the end of the day, when you come back to your normal state of mind, then that's the time to think about the process, to talk about it. Mm. So we discourage them from talking about it, even though there's an art. I mean, you don't tell the person to shush, you know, because it's a very vulnerable state, you know. It's like, see, you also don't want to be rude to anybody, but you know, but there's an art form to encouraging them to kind of go inward, because it really seems through clinical observation dating back to the 1950s that that's where you tend to get the most meaningful, therapeutically useful responses, is when you use high doses and you encourage people to essentially introspect, but not, you know, again, not, don't report on it till later. But and the way this was described, there was this really interesting book by Masters in Houston, not to be confused with Masters in Johnson, but Masters in Houston, The Varieties of Psychedelic Experience, where they describe these different kind of, and they were Freudian, or at least I think more Jungian. They were psychodynamic, you know, therapists, Jungian, and so that kind of colored their interpretation. But I think there's something to their general description out of seeing thousands of these psychedelic therapy sessions. That at one level, it's the perceptual, perceptual level, and that's what we kind of think of when we use terms like hallucinogen. Yes, the walls might be waiting, colors might be more intense, but there is some idea that if people, especially recreationally, unless they're guided elsewhere, they get stuck there. Hey, look at the pretty colors. Oh, look at the trails waving, you know, off my hand when I move it, that type of thing. It's kind of, you might miss some kind of the more interesting and more beneficial experiences that one might have, and one kind of gets stuck there. So that's kind of what the eye shades are and the headphones, kind of creating this introspective framework. But then going deeper, they describe a personal autobiographical level. They call it the psychodynamic level, but I think of more as just the autobiographical level, just about your life. I mean, so it's not, often people have just very vivid memories and contemplations of their childhood, of their family relationships, their family dynamics, past and current. Just there's situations in life, conflicts, situations with friends, struggles that, you know, their life, the stuff, the stories in their life. So that kind of personal autobiographical level. And then another layer below that, which they call, again, from a Jungian perspective, the symbolic archetypal level. The idea here, you're getting to highly symbolic realms where some of the best descriptors you can map on the experience are perhaps those from, common, themes, the hero's journey and these types of, supposed archetypes. And then they say a final level they call mystical integral level. And that's where the subject experience of subject and object completely break down.
Is that like the ego death?
Yeah, so this is the type of thing that's described with all sorts of ways and scientifically, especially someone trained as a behaviorist. It's like, I just want to be very careful. These are all descriptions we don't really know. Like, what is the ego even? Like, But I think there is something that, in terms of the biological machinery that affords us, there's like, we do perceive the world as other and us. And that seems to be some, at the very core level, a necessary component of our psychological experience. And it seems that these compounds can tinker with that in very interesting ways to dissolve that experience. And it seems that people can tinker their brains in other ways, be it through fasting and all these, intense meditation and those types of things, to get into those states as well. But so, that, at least at the biological level, to me, that you might kind of move from sort of an area where there's not a lot to anchor onto in terms of archetypes, but then kind of you get into a level that actually might mean something more at the biological level, in terms of, while ego loss may still be, highfalutin terminology, I could easily, in terms of something biologically interacting with having a sense of agency. It seems like that's not highfalutin.
Well, and there's some behavioral precedent, I guess I would say, for this type of you know, in relational frame theory, which is sort of the basis of acceptance and commitment therapy, which I don't honestly know enough to speak super intelligently about, but there might be an interesting connection there with some of that behavioral stuff. But yeah, that's that's go ahead, Noah. You guys.
I totally agree. And yeah, I think it's interesting to hear you kind of talk about it scientifically, as all of my experience with hallucinogen is almost through kind of like autobiographical recall from people. Right. And they always describe it in this phase, like stepwise process, where it's like, initially it starts off, you know, the gradual build, then which usually starts off as perceptual, at least in part, along with a physiological arousal that occurs with it, right? So the body fry, as they would call it, right? And then the visual hallucinatory kind of perceptual sets in at the peak phase of it. And then it subsides over time. And then they usually describe it, at least in my conversations with individuals, as this like really interesting, like reflective cognitive experience whereby things that they haven't thought about or have been thinking deeply about start to become more clear to them. And they often talk about this experience, the back end of it, where everybody who's been tripping all night has this kind of bonded conversation about like, I finally figured it out. Like this thing I've been thinking about, or I finally discovered a thing that I didn't even know I was looking to figure out. And here's what I should do with it. That happens like on the back end after all of those perceptual things have subsided, but the cognitive experience of it lives on in them on the back end of the, on the back end of it, which always sounded incredibly therapeutic. By definition almost. And so it's interesting to hear that like even the science is able to follow along with these things, even though we may not have the words to describe them that we all agree upon, but at least we all agree that there's like these phases to it that appear therapeutic in nature.
Right, and which is really interesting. Yeah, we can say that. I mean, people are changing. People are. I think by definition, it's learning, and that's that. And it's interesting that some of the rodent models are showing increased neuroplasticity, and even in in rats, in the days following psychedelic, use. I think people are. Provide it with novel psychological perspectives. And that's including insight in their own problems. It's not, but it's an interesting thing because it's not that we could say everything that's experienced on these compounds is ground truth. In fact, they can induce delusion. But it's almost like there's this flexibility that's imposed in the system. And that's one kind of leading idea that what's happening through the serotonin 2A agonism, it's relaxing the influence of priors, like bottom, top down, prosic expectations, kind of leading heuristics, kind of
that's fascinating.
Leading cognition.
That is really interesting.
The idea that, one can view things more like a child through fresh eyes with less of the years and years of, heuristics and biases that we've all layered up, which are really useful, but they also put you in.
That sounds like behaviorism at its finest, right? Without being prisoner to your learning history.
Right.
So that's interesting. Cause I've kind of played with thinking about these ideas. There's something about the effect that it's learning at the basic learning level. The real challenge with behavior change is so much learning is context, like extinction is context specific. The rat now doesn't transfer as readily as the original learning. But it really seems that like what people learn in these sessions tends to be more context independent. It seems like, and maybe another way to express it less behaviorally is like the lessons people learn are so deep down, the more at the level of identity and life priorities.
Yeah.
that essentially kind of describe molar behavior. You could, you know, and so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is really interesting. So I know you're one of the only people that has like an NIH funded study to look at this stuff in the context of addiction. And so I was wondering how these mechanisms you're describing here kind of play out in the addiction space, and like what is your thinking as it relates to that?
Yeah. So, we've gotten very promising behavioral data with treating tobacco addiction. So very high success rates in a pilot study with 80% biologically confirmed point prevalent abstinent at 6 months. Wow. And at an average of 2.5 years, 60%. Now, it was a small sample of 15 people, but, you know, the questions were, you know, is this feasible and is it promising enough to pursue further?
Right.
So the answer is, well, definitely. I mean, those are just very high success rates. But it could have been, you know, that, you know, yeah, maybe it wasn't the psilocybin, you know, it wasn't a randomized study. Right now we're doing a comparative efficacy study where people are randomized to one open label psilocybin session versus a standard course of nicotine patch, both with the same cognitive behavioral therapy. And that was a part of the first study. I should have said the first study was 3 psilocybin sessions, but the current study is just 1 session, mainly because we're doing fMRI, not during the session, but before and after people quit to see it. Some biological.
Still doing 3 sessions, just 2 of them are fMRI.
Yeah. And so the, right, it's not a blinded study, so know what the results are at any given time. So like in terms of point prevalence, abstinence, it's like at this point for the people who have gotten, for the 61 people who have gotten to the 1 year follow-up, it's 58% abstinent in the psilocybin group and 28% in the nicotine patch group, which is not the official answer because the study is in mostly done with our sample. We're going to 100 people, but so it's not the, so it doesn't count for anything officially, but it's just out of curiosity, does it look like we're still on track? Yeah, you know, it still looks really promising. Mm. And those were data that I used to land the NIDA grant that you mentioned, which hasn't started yet, but we're now moving through the paperwork and whatnot to do that. So it's we've had some real success so far in terms of how it's working. You could just answer that at several levels. I mean, we did a qualitative analysis where we got people's, you know, answers to this. I could say a few things about that. That we are doing before and after. I mentioned the imaging. We're doing that in both stuff like resting state imaging, fMRI, as well as pass-phase. Something we found, I'm more interested in the behavioral results, like the cognitive task, you know, that we're also scanning during, but on so-called a measure of cognitive control, the MCIT, the multi-source interference task. It's called the oddball task. It's kind of like the Stroop task in the sense that you're charged with inhibiting a prepotent response. Like you wanna give this type of answer, but it's really hard not to, and you have to make a split second, you know, inhibitory. You have to inhibit that response in a split. And it's one of these things like a number is showing up on the screen. You have to use one of your 3 fingers, each one has a number associated with your 3 fingers, and you have to use the finger with the same. I know this sounds crazy, but it's the finger number associated with that particular finger, not the one that's in the same spatial location as your finger. Anyway, it's really hard to do. And it turns out the day after they quit smoking with psilocybin, they're significantly better at that. They're less sort of tripped up by these interference trials where there's this incongruity between these competing stimuli.
Yeah.
And
which is an analog, right, of a quit attempt. right? Like my prepotent response is to smoke, yes, but I want to not, right?
So I've speculated this might be early evidence of relating to, like, I always think of our one volunteer with the anecdote. He said, well, the cravings come now, they're there, but it's like I'm Neo from the Matrix where the bullets are in that slow motion kind of world where I can just kind of lean backwards real slowly and let the bullet fly. I say, oh, it's a craving. I'll feel fine in 3 minutes. Like, whatever. I quit smoking 2 weeks ago. Whatever. Wow. It's gonna, and just sort of like watch it fly by. Bye-bye. You know, take that mindfulness response to it rather than just the automaticity of, you know, hand in the pocket to grab the cigarette. Like, not there. Turn the car into the convenience store to buy the cigarette.
Right.
You know, just like, boom, you know, sort of that, keeping that more mindful response.
It's really, really interesting. Yeah, because one of the questions I had was like, you know, a lot of people in therapy, you know, Noah and I, you know, see clients, and a lot of times when I'm teaching people mindfulness, or, you know, or I do come from an acceptance and commitment therapy lens quite often. And, you know, sometimes people are very fused to their thoughts. It's hard to get them to step out of that space. It's hard to get them to be mindful, or to teach them mindfulness. And I guess I was wondering, and this is kind of going back, and I think I'm getting off topic a little bit, but do you find that most people, you know, that there are individual differences in their ability to sort of enter some of these spaces, or do you feel that using psilocybin actually can help people do that better? I mean, it sounds like your answer in part to the cigarette question is that it actually does help them do that better.
Yeah, enter into these spaces. I guess it depends on what exactly you mean. Sort of, maybe you could say a little more about.
Sorry,
that.
Becoming mindful and being able to step away, because a lot of times the idea is that we get so caught up in the moment that it's sort of, we feel like we are the craving, right? Or we, you know, but instead you can step out. So I'm wondering about that, like the ability to sort of step away and be mindful.
I think so. I don't know. We probably need to look at it more, I don't know, with greater power and better precision, but I don't think we've picked up any changes in like the measures of trait mindfulness. I don't know the degree to which they're going to be able to pick up on that, but anyway, it might be worth revisiting that. But it seems that people report anecdotally, like, you know, cases, a lot of cases where they're saying specifically things like their experience during the session was a microcosm of lesson for how to behave in life. Sort of like, oh, the more I fought it, the harder it became. The more I let go into it, the more I actually like realized that it
was safe,
the issue wasn't there in the first place, and are able to move through it. So it's like almost like this operant conditioning in the black box of like, is how these mental responses really do, like how, like, wow, I'm creating my own suffering. Like with the cancer patients, that was like a common. So it seems like that. Now that I don't know whether
really
it's opening the space for them to experience that on a daily basis after the session, or if simply the memory, even if that doesn't happen, the memory of that
as the operant.
You know, can be just maybe.
Well, yeah.
Do the trick too. You know, maybe even
it gets
if
flagged by the
memory to...
systems as a very memorable experience, right? Like it's easy to grab onto in the future. To recall and to use in that. But the thing you said there, I think, is really right, like the creating my own suffering thing is like literally right out of some of the writings around ACT, right? About like that, like pain is inevitable, right? But suffering is optional. And the idea that like the more we fight it, the more we create the symptoms by which that we're trying to push away and thus get stuck in this feedback loop of trying to get rid of it. And therefore it's always with me. And so that is really interesting. I think component to it that allows the person to be able to kind of experience that in like a very brief and memorable way by which that they can recall and use as leverage for future situations, coupled with this interesting difference in cognitive control that you've kind of been able to capture with the controlling for the fact that this is an unfinished trial and that things are still in works, but That is an interesting combination of things.
Yeah, and you made me think of I'm going to be starting a trial with using LSD to treat chronic pain, and So yeah, that we're going to see there. Like I think there's this component across all of these disorders where, and that's like one of like that's the $1 million question. Like, why in the world does this seem to like work for everything? Like, when it doesn't work for everything, but it is quite remarkable the early data across these different. Not only right. different forms of addiction, different substances disorders, but like depression and for cancer patients or major depressive disorder, or you know, and so like how is it, working? That's just like kind of the huge.
That's a huge
question in this field, and I think it's because all of these disorders are connected at that kind of very fundamental level of. That we're talking about, like one, like people are stuck in patterns with all of these disorders, whether it's primarily defined behaviorally, like a substance use disorder, whether it's primarily defined in terms of cognitions, but obviously tons of behavioral manifestations, like in depression, but like, or in this particular case of cancer, like these are all cases where you can argue it's the people are stuck into suboptimal patterns where there's this recognition. There's often this cognitive recognition, like, yeah, I know. They can tell you exactly what their problem is, exactly that they should quit the substance or that,
right.
you know, and that they'd even be better off if they, or if they don't need to think about themselves in that way. But yeah, right. It's easier said than done for all of it. But it seems like stuff like that, where it's normally you're just dealing with easier said than done and some very, very good therapies that take, you know, time and commitment and the right, you know, professional training, you know, that can work. It does seem like you get some of that similar psychotherapeutic process in this supercharged, like not all the time, but sometimes you get, I think of it like psychotherapy in the, you know, in the black box, like someone's going through they are like learning lessons about, like, you know, about how they're really fundamentally, it's almost like the simplest form of learning is habituation. And kind of a correlate of that is we're not focused on the things that are so deeply ingrained in us. They're the most invisible to us, you know, like the water is invisible to the fish type of thing. And like, and that's how all of these disorders, whether it's substance use disorders or depression, we're dealing with cancer, that's, you know, they all have that aspect to them, and this kind of like it shakes the snow globe up so that it at least temporarily really alters perspective, and people can sometimes have insights on those things that normally they can speak to at a more mundane level, or they tell themselves like it, but now like instead of feeling it in their head or saying it in their head, now they have this like they feel it in their heart, like it's so crystal clear to them.
Yeah.
And that has such a sticking power.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not just some drug effect that changed the symptoms. No, it's however we got here, this person had a powerful personal psychological insight that had the power to change their life. Yeah. However, and it was prompted by a drug, but it was different than what we normally think of as psychiatric pharmacotherapy.
Yeah, that's it right there. I think it's an important point, right? That everybody I've talked to who has done psychedelics, right? Like describe this like aha moment that happens at some point during the experience. And that if we take everything we've talked about thus far and the anecdotal experience I've collected, that it's like, you know, they had like 6 months of therapy that collapsed into 12 hours. And it like had like in therapy, when I work with people, they have aha moments all the time, but they're like really far apart and they take a long ass time to get there and a bunch of hard work. Right. And none of those happen when a person is taking SSRIs or things like this, right? Like it just slowly fades into the background versus having like this prominent experience of like, oh, that's it. Right. Like, and that has like a very, like a, as you stated, like a sticking power, right? It gets flagged in our memory in a meaningful way that allow us to access it in times of need and to work, you know, has a potential to kind of shift gears, you know, values, life priorities, as you kind of referenced already, in really meaningful ways. And there's that's really interesting.
And there's a sense of agency that I think, I suspect, is part of why when psychedelics work, and again, not everything works every time for every person, but when they really work well, one of the things I can't, it's so striking to me, is that here's a person who really has done the heavy lifting. They really, when someone feels healed from these substances, they have had profoundly emotional experiences, or they have felt things to a depth that they had not experienced before. They have really worked for it. And that's what I think some people who aren't very familiar with the area, they don't get when they hear, they think, oh, some hippie's going to numb themselves out. They're taking some crazy drug to just get high and escape their problems. The whole idea, like, no, these sessions bring all of your problems come crashing down on you, and they force you to deal with them. I mean, when it plays out right, it's like that. And so often people come out of these sessions saying, my God, especially if they have no history of any recreational use. Like, how in the world did people take this for fun? You know, there's like, it's so incomprehensible. So there's a sense of agency where you've done your own. When someone feels that they really have, like for smoking cessation, it really feels that like they've gotten closer to the psychological roots of deciding, like, I don't need that. I'm choosing not to have that in my life. That doesn't fit. And it seems like there's this, an ownership. Whereas, and again, I don't want to trash the other medications, but where it doesn't work, you know, like for the people whom it doesn't work, you know, sort of like nicotine replacement, you can understand like that may be something that's not there that would be helpful. You know, like there could be some sense that like, yes, this is making the cravings easier. Like it's literally what it's doing. It's curbing the withdrawal at least. Mm-hmm. And so it is a crutch, and that's fine. Again, and crutches work, I'm all for a crutch. But in terms of why a crutch can only do so much, you know, I think that's, you know, that's, you know, it's only dealing with those like kind of surface level effects that mediate the drug response, you know, tobacco. But it does not really affect the addiction, which I view as this much larger construct defining the relationship between that person and the rest of the world, including that particular addictive activity. But it's more of this broader, you know, context that's more about like who am I as a person, what's important in life, what, you know, how does this affect these other relationships that I'm in my life, and these various roles that I have.
Yeah.
Man, that makes total sense. I got one last question for you before we maybe pivot to some of our take home messages, which is just around feasibility and dissemination. And so I have a lot of students who are interested in psilocybin and its treatments or treatment potential. And my biggest question has always been like, how can we move this out into a space where people use it regularly, given like, so somebody has to take a dose and they're at a hospital for hours and they can't go to work. They can't do these other types of things. Also, hospital stays are very expensive. And so I was just curious a little bit about what the vision is for the future of that. As we move toward, if we get the data that leads us to a place where we disseminate, what's the vision for that?
Yeah. So if it gets through phase 3 trials, which it feasibly could in the next 3 to 5 years, you know, for a particular disorder like depression, let's say, which might be the leading example for psilocybin, then it's, you know, there's a lot to figure out. The FDA is probably gonna, I think they should impose a program around it, a so-called REMS program that can define certain rules around its use. So I would hope that it would be restricted to a setting with the right, you know, safeguards in it, and that people have to follow, you know, sort of the safety procedures that have been in place in the research that has, you know, led to its approval. There's going to be all kinds of treatment models. There are already lots of companies that are anticipating different kind of models of treatment. So, you know, standalone kind of brick and mortar, you know, clinics where they just kind of specialize this rather than being in a room in a hospital. Actually, I kind of think a room in a hospital is probably not going to be likely because
that sounds like a terrible place to trip.
Right. And also you don't need it. I mean, I think there's that you need some level of medical monitoring, but it, you know, maybe midwifery might be a good example of where, like, you know, you want, yeah, if you end up needing some medical help, like there's the plan right there and there's like not too far. It's there, but you don't need to be in the center necessarily of the hospital to do something that typically doesn't require that. So, I think, and there are folks working on shorter acting compounds that they're hoping could more easily fit into clinical practice. So I think there's going to be, you know, the future is going to be complex. I do think this is going to be something that's going to need to be in a therapist's office. There's, you know, even though, you know, I think I'm actually all for kind of decriminalizing drug use in general, just because the public health data on, you know, like we're not helping the situation by getting misdemeanors and felonies for any drug, you know, for heroin and methamphetamine, et cetera. In that sense, though, I don't, you know, I'm not sort of, you know, I don't encourage sort of the self, self-therapy, you know, sort of movement, in the sense that, I don't know, some of these, like, these initiatives to decriminalize psychedelics will, even if I agree with it in an ultimate aim of, like, on the principle that, yeah, we should find better ways to deal with the problems with drugs than, you know, giving criminal penalties for use for, you end up essentially criminalizing a mental health disorder for those that have a substance use disorder, which is going to be a good chunk. Some of these initiatives sort of will say, like, well, because of the promise at places like Hopkins, like these things, medical potential, like they should be decriminalized. And I don't agree with that rationale. Hey, if that's your rationale, then we're on an FDA pathway. Wait for phase 3 trial results. You know, I don't think you need that rationale. Like, you know, I think the same kind of approach of decriminalization holds for drugs, none of which you want to encourage anyone to use, but just as a realistic way to address the problems without making things worse for people. So it's a complex area. I think clinicians are basically going to have to wait for FDA approval. Now there is, you know, there's an initiative in Oregon that's actually not just decriminalized, but legalized psilocybin mushroom therapy, but they're in this 2-year period where they're supposed to figure out how this is going to work. And so I'm really waiting to see how that's going to work. Right. I'm not sure how, you know, if the degree to the law covers both kind of treatment of disorders and you know, basically anybody else that wants to undergo these sessions.
Self-exploration.
So, self-exploration, call it what you will. But, you know, when you're talking about treating disorders, then you're talking about the treatment of, you're talking about the practice of medicine. You're talking about the practice of clinical psychology. Yeah. Like, and there are some rules surrounding those professions and people claim to do that for very good reason. And so I am very concerned about that this ultimately be interfaced with medicine and with psychology.
Like anything with decriminalization or legalization, like really good regulation seems like, you know, a rule.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You need to, and I'm concerned with sort of like, hey, we know like severe cardiovascular risk is a is I didn't mention that one, but you know, not for most folks, even if you're uncontrolled, you know, antihypertensives, you know, that's fine. But people at the more severe levels, like possibly raises blood pressure, but you know, out there, if you don't put the right rules on, I mean, someone's going to have
right,
you know, one of those forms that takes 1 minute, you know, check yes or no whether you've ever had these disorders. It's like, take the guy's blood pressure. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, and because you know what the right answer is, you know, it's like you sure some of these things you fly to one of these retreats in Jamaica, and it's like, you better answer no to everything, or else you just wasted that $1,000 plane trip.
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, Matt, this has been awesome. I think I could talk about this for days and months and years. Honestly, it's a fascinating topic, and it's really exciting to see what's going on and where this is going. So thank you so much for your time. First of all, you're welcome. And we'd like to transition, if that's okay, to the take homes. We know we're sort of coming up to our time, but so we can answer these relatively briefly if you'd like.
What would you say that the take home message is about this, the psilocybin work that you're doing here for practitioners that are listening? What do they need to know about this?
For practitioners who really love to come upon aha moments and to really feel like they're doing psychologically meaty work with people that's going to have a real impact on their lives, I think folks should be excited about the possibility of this psychedelic therapy coming down the line as an improved treatment. I think it just has the ability to really touch people's lives, and you see visceral changes that it's going to be a real favorite. And it obviously has a real home with psychologists. I mean, this is ultimately operating at the psychological level. I mean, it's a medication that prompts an altered state of consciousness, but it's the psychological insights that people are having.
What would you say your research has to say to policymakers?
Psilocybin hasn't passed the ultimate trials yet, phase 3 trials, but it's looking very promising. I will say, in terms of its trajectory to be an improved medication, and I will say, in terms of the harms that we know that psilocybin can cause, is think that we have the right strategies to squarely mitigate those to a very reasonable level. But the devil's in the details. It has to be done right. If it's not done right, there's going to be harms. So, so this has to be well regulated.
What would you say is a take-home message for underserved populations?
Oh, I think there's a lot of potential here with these psychedelic therapies for underserved populations. I mean, I think a lot of what you, is an overrepresentation in underserved populations in some of these, you know, really difficult to treat, you know, disorders, given the life circumstances. So there's a reason, depression, substance use disorders of the various types. So the folks who happen to be in underrepresented populations who are dealing with those struggles, I think there's a lot of hope. But I would say in general, it's not just psychedelics. I think in terms of treatment in general, there's a lot of hope. And it may not be, a psychedelic treatment for a particular person. But I think also there's kind of growing interest in discussion of explicit use of psychedelics as to treat racial-based trauma and things like this. So something we need more research on, but I think is a really good bet. So I think kind of multiple ways, direct and indirect, where it could be of interest to underrepresented minorities.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Matt. And just the last question we have for you. You've been really successful you're obviously sort of paving the path for this, you know, new area of hopefully of medicine. And so do you have any advice for trainees out there who, you know, who are trying to find their foothold in this field?
Yeah. Establish yourself in whatever adjacent area really firmly, even if it has to, if it takes kind of jumping into the psychedelic area, even if it delays that. So like if you're, say you have a choice in terms of going into graduate school, working with kind of a new faculty member, you know, who's new themselves in the field, assistant professor, but, you know, they're doing something with psychedelics, but they're not kind of well established, you know, scientifically. You know, that if your other option is someone who is not, hasn't done anything with psychedelics, but is just like super well connected and respected and seen as a, rightfully so, as a really great scientist and a mentor, like learn from that person. So whether like, if you want to go into, you know, treatment of addiction with psychedelics, we'll become an expert in addiction. If you want to be, you know, treat PTSD trauma with psychedelics, become an expert in trauma treatment, you know, et cetera, you know, become, and even if it takes delaying that other thing, because you really, you really need to be an expert. And like for me, it's like my basis was in, you know, in behavioral psychology and in addictions, you know, understand the effects of drugs. Like those are kind of my scientific bases that intersect. And at the clinical level, certainly the addictions treatment stuff intersect. So that's what I'd recommend.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. And,
seriously,
hope to get to talk to you again some more about this at some point. It's awesome.
That would be great.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.